I'm going to have our next speaker. This is the University of Iowa, by the way. That's the undergraduate campus, and there's our medical center and medical school. Very nice, and you should come visit us sometime. But we're going to have Matt Kulke come up and talk to us about the medical management. And Matt is the head of medical oncology here at Boston University Medical Center. He just moved from Dana-Farber. He's also an expert in the medical oncologic treatment of the diseases, has done many clinical trials, and we're really fortunate to have him as an expert here today.
Thank you, Jim and Electron, for inviting me over. It's a privilege to be here, and especially nice that the commute from work is only about 10 minutes from Boston Medical Center. So I'm really thrilled to talk to you a little bit about the medical management of neuroendocrine tumors today. I do have disclosures from Lexicon, Novartis, and Ipsen. As we think about the medical management of neuroendocrine tumors, I really think about this in two broad categories. One is how do we manage some of the symptoms of hormone hypersecretion that were talked about a little bit earlier, and then second is how do we think about managing tumor growth? What do we use for tumor control? So I'm going to start by talking about symptoms of hormone secretion. And here we actually have several different options. Somatostatin analogs certainly are the mainstay and have been for many years. But we also need to think about specific management of hormone-related symptoms in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, which can be quite diverse. And then also talk a little bit about carcinoid syndrome, not just somatostatin analogs now, but also telotrostat ethyl. So starting with pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, it does turn out that the majority of these tumors are so-called non-functional. So they may even secrete hormones if you test them in the blood, but very often they may not be associated with clear symptoms of hormone hypersecretion. The other 30 to 40%, though, do have clear symptoms of hormone hypersecretion, which can vary. A number of different hormones can be secreted. On the right, you see a patient who had a glucagonoma presenting with a classic skin rash called necrolytic migratory erythema. And there are, of course, other syndromes, such as those associated with insulinoma, hypoglycemia, and even less common ones like those associated with gastrinoma or even secretion of vasoactive intestinal peptide called VIPomas. So there are a number of different ways that you treat these syndromes. A patient with insulinoma, for example, one might start with dietary modifications. There is a drug called diazoxide that directly inhibits insulin secretion in these patients. More recently, there's also evidence that the mTOR inhibitor, everolimus, that we'll talk about a little bit later, is also highly effective in improving glycemic control in these patients and should definitely be strongly considered. Patients with glucagonoma, like the one I showed you the picture of, often respond extremely well initially to somatostatin analogs. Similarly, those patients with VIPoma who have profound diarrhea will respond very well to initial management with somatostatin analogs. Patients with gastrinoma who have hypersecretion as well as diarrhea will often respond very well initially simply to proton pump inhibitors, often for many years, but we will consider somatostatin analogs as these patients begin to progress. Now, the story with carcinoid tumors is a little bit different. Carcinoids can arise from just about anywhere in the body. We still do think about them according to their site of origin and classify them as foregut carcinoid tumors, those arising in the lungs and bronchi or the stomach, midgut carcinoids, such as those arising in the small intestine and appendix, and hindgut carcinoid tumors, such as those arising in the rectum. Now, carcinoid syndrome, of course, is associated with carcinoid tumors. Is actually much more common in those patients who have small intestine or appendiceal primaries, and usually only seen in those patients who have liver disease or perhaps retroperitoneal disease. It's less common in carcinoids arising from other areas. It can manifest in a variety of different ways, including, of course, profound diarrhea, which is the most common, but also episodic flushing. And in the later stages, you see the fibrosis, often around the small bowel primary tumor, and then, of course, in the right-sided heart valves, typically the tricuspid valve. So how do we think about managing carcinoid syndrome? As I mentioned before, somatostatin analogs remain the mainstay for initial treatment of these patients, but over years, in some cases, the efficacy of somatostatin analogs can wear off. This is where a new drug, telotrostat ethyl, comes in. Telotrostat ethyl is an oral inhibitor of tryptophan hydroxylase, which is the rate-limiting enzyme in serotonin biosynthesis. Several early phase studies showed initial evidence that this could be effective in patients with symptoms of carcinoid syndrome. And those studies led to a more recent randomized trial called the TELESTAR trial. This was a study in which patients who had carcinoid syndrome and were already on somatostatin analogs were randomized to three different arms, either placebo, telotrostat ethyl at 250 milligrams three times a day, or telotrostat at a dose of 500 milligrams three times a day. They were then followed for 12 weeks, and the bowel movement frequency in these patients was measured. The results of this study did show that treatment with telotrostat at either the 250 milligram or the 500 milligram dose worked. You can see here the response curves. What's actually really interesting about these particular curves is that the curve at the top, the gray curve, is actually the placebo arm. So this is very clear evidence of a placebo effect. It's not a myth. But you do also see further decreases in bowel movement frequency in those patients who received either the 250 milligram or the 500 milligram dose. What you also see after 12 weeks, those patients who were on placebo crossed over to receive telotrostat, and you see a further decrease there, again demonstrating the efficacy of telotrostat in patients who have refractory carcinoid syndrome already on somatostatin analog. So this is now a clear option for these particular patients. Let me move on now to talk about tumor control. And this is always a bit of a judgment call. As we've also talked about here already, patients with neuroendocrine tumors, particularly the low-grade ones, which tend to be more common, often do somewhat better than patients with other types of malignancy. Sometimes they can live for years even without treatment. If you look at median survivals, though, it does become clear that over time, these patients do die from their disease. And just as one example, median survival for metastatic small intestine neuroendocrine tumors in this particular study was between 5 to 6 years. So we do need to think about how to slow down or even stop the tumor growth, ideally shrink those tumors for patients with metastatic disease. So what are the options that we have for tumor control? Well, here again, somatostatin analogs do come into play. Liver-directed therapy is an important option. Cytotoxic chemotherapy can also be used, particularly in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And more recently, we've seen the development of molecular targeted therapies and, of course, peptide receptor radiotherapy. So if we start again with somatostatin analogs, both octreotide and more recently the similar somatostatin analog lanreotide are effective in slowing the growth for neuroendocrine tumors. Octreotide was initially tested in a study called the PROMID study. In this particular study, treatment with octreotide LAR at a dose of 30 milligrams monthly clearly improved time to tumor progression. And in a subsequent study, this one actually performed not just in carcinoid tumors as the PROMID study was, but also pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. This study randomized patients to receive either treatment with lanreotide monthly or to placebo and showed a clear improvement in progression-free survival associated with lanreotide. So either of these drugs can be highly effective in improving progression-free survival in slowing down tumor growth, although as we've heard, they don't really ever shrink the tumor. So what other options do we have if we need to shrink the tumor or if over time the tumors start to grow? I do want to mention here again that liver-directed therapies are an important consideration in these patients. Often the liver is the primary or even the only site of metastatic disease, and in those patients with limited liver disease, surgical resection is clearly an important option. In other patients, such as those on the right, where the liver is chock full of disease and surgery is not an option, we also think very hard about chemoembolization, which can be an important, very effective option in appropriately selected patients. In thinking about systemic options, there are a number of options here. I'm going to start with options for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. It turns out that cytotoxic chemotherapy is far more effective in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors than it is in carcinoid tumors. There were several initial studies looking at the alkylating agent temozolomide in advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, either alone or in various different combinations. And in several of these studies, which were done both prospectively and retrospectively, one of the combinations that seemed to be particularly effective was this combination of temozolomide and capecitabine. Nobody really knew until very recently just how best to use temozolomide. Should it be alone or should it be in combination? And that study was actually done by Pam Kunz at Stanford and reported out at ASCO this past year. This was a randomized study in which patients with advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors were randomized to receive either single-agent temozolomide or this combination of temozolomide and capecitabine. What the study showed is that tumor response rates were actually fairly similar between the two arms, about 28% for temozolomide alone and 33% for temozolomide and capecitabine. What was particularly interesting, though, is that the combination of temozolomide and capecitabine clearly had superior progression-free survival. Progression-free survival was 22 months for the combination versus only 14 months for temozolomide alone. And overall survival was also better in the patients who received temozolomide and capecitabine. It was not reached in the combination arm and 38 months in the temozolomide alone arm. So this combination now of temozolomide and capecitabine is a clear and important option for patients with advanced PNET, resulting, as I showed you, not just in tumor responses, but also in improved PFS and improved overall survival. Now, there are a number of other options as well. Molecular targeted therapies have been all the rage for the past few years, and they do work in patients with advanced neuroendocrine tumors. Sunitinib was one of the earlier agents that was looked at initially in a phase 2 study that was done in both carcinoid and pancreatic islet cell tumors. In this particular phase 2 study, it seemed to be somewhat more effective in the patients with advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, and that led to a randomized study of sunitinib versus placebo in advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors that was reported out in the New England Journal in 2011 and showed a clear improvement in progression-free survival in those patients receiving sunitinib. So this was the study that led to the FDA approval of sunitinib in 2011 for advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And that very same year, also in 2011, the results of another study called RADIANT-3 were reported out. This was a study in patients with advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors that were randomized to either everolimus, an mTOR inhibitor, or a placebo. And in this particular study, everolimus was associated with improved progression-free survival of 11 months versus 4.6 months. Now, this study led that same year to FDA approval of everolimus for patients with advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Now, carcinoid tumors have kind of lagged behind a little bit, at least in terms of the development of new drugs. But just a few years ago, the results of RADIANT-4, another randomized study, were reported. This was a study for patients with advanced carcinoid tumors who were randomized to either everolimus or placebo. And this study showed improved progression-free survival in advanced carcinoid of 11.0 months for everolimus and only 3.9 months for placebo. Now, this study ultimately led to the FDA approval of everolimus now for carcinoid tumors, again, just a few years ago. So how do we put all of this together? It can be a little bit confusing. We have systemic options for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, including somatostatin analogs, which are generally used first because they're easy, have a very good side effect profile. We then have everolimus, sunitinib, and then, of course, most recently, temozolomide and capecitabine. For carcinoid tumors, we also generally start with somatostatin analogs, and as I just showed you, everolimus has now also become a good systemic option for patients with advanced carcinoid disease. Now, if that weren't complicated enough, just in the past year, we've had results associated with peptide receptor radionucleotide therapy, and we're going to be talking about this in the next session, so I'm not going to go into it in detail. But just to say that this is a very attractive strategy where you attach a radioisotope to a somatostatin analog and use the analog to essentially deliver highly targeted radiotherapy to neuroendocrine tumors expressing somatostatin receptors. And the key study here was the so-called NETTER-1 study that showed that treatment with Lutathera, in this case, was associated with a fairly dramatic improvement in progression-free survival. It was actually not reached in this particular study in 8.4 months in what was effectively a placebo arm. Those patients had been on somatostatin analogs, continued to receive somatostatin analogs in that study. So if we look at the options again, we've added now Lutathera potentially to both pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and carcinoid. How do you decide between the two? And the true answer is nobody's actually quite sure. What we do think about is anti-tumor activity, such as response rates, which are quite high for temozolomide capecitabine, 33%, only 18% for Lutathera, and actually quite low if we think about sunitinib and everolimus, which are much better at simply stabilizing the tumor. We also balance, of course, the potential toxicities. Temozolomide capecitabine can be associated with immunosuppression. With Lutathera, again, quite effective, very exciting, but over the long term, you do worry about myelodysplastic syndrome and some renal side effects. And then there are other specific side effects with sunitinib, like hypertension or everolimus and stomatitis. So again, it really becomes a balance, a judgment call, looking at both anti-tumor activity and some of the potential toxicities. In the last few minutes, I just want to mention what is coming down the road in the future. There have been additional advances, at least with regard to molecularly targeted therapies. The tyrosine kinase inhibitor cabozantinib was tested in a phase 2 study reported at ASCO a couple of years ago. This was a phase 2 that was done in both pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and carcinoid tumors, and impressively, at least for molecularly targeted agents, showed very encouraging response rates in both tumor types. So based on this phase 2 study, there's now an ongoing randomized study, this one in both carcinoid and pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors who have failed treatment with the mTOR inhibitor everolimus and are being randomized to receive either cabozantinib or placebo. The study just recently opened. It's being led by my colleague Jennifer Chan through the cooperative groups. It's actually intended as a registration study. So if positive, this would lead to potentially approval of yet another new drug for patients with advanced neuroendocrine tumors. The last thing I just want to mention is immunotherapy. Immunotherapy has clearly been a revolution, I would say, in terms of systemic treatment for a number of different malignancies. There's huge interest in whether or not it'll work in neuroendocrine tumors. The answer is not really in yet. I will say that in a relatively recent study in our group, we looked at expression of PD-L1 and PD-L2 in both pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and small intestine neuroendocrine tumors. Expression, at least on the membrane, was really quite low. So it looks like neuroendocrine tumors, for the most part, don't really express the targets that are now being targeted with PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors. The potentially good news is that these are only some of the checkpoint inhibitors. This mechanism and immune targets are increasingly being studied. There's a whole family of potential checkpoint pathways that could be targeted and are being investigated actively now in a number of different malignancies. And our group currently is undertaking a study to really better characterize the immune environment of neuroendocrine tumors using single-cell sequencing to try to get a very high-resolution look at the immune environment of neuroendocrine tumors and potentially identify new targets that could, down the road, be used for immunotherapy in this tumor type, as is currently being done successfully in other tumor types. So just to conclude, take-home message is that there are many systemic options now for advanced neuroendocrine tumors. If we go back to the 1970s, there was only streptozocin, a drug that most of us would prefer to forget. Subsequently, the development of octreotide, interferon, temozolomide, sunitinib, everolimus, and as we go down most recently, as I showed you, telotrastat for patients with carcinoid syndrome. Lutathera, just recently FDA approved, and hopefully many more drugs over the next few years. So thanks so much for your attention.
Thank you.